It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The NFL returns for real tonight when the Packers and Bears go head-to-head in Chicago. We'll preview the game, look at the Packers' offseason moves, and whether they can bounce back from last year's disappointing season. First, fears of a recession have been percolating for the last few months. That's due in part to ongoing trade disputes with other countries, along with some warning signs in the bond markets. In many ways, millennials have been defined by the Great Recession. Many people in the generation have seen skyrocketing student loan debt, graduated during one of the worst job markets in U.S. history, and haven't been able to build long-term savings or buy real estate because of the sluggish economy they came to age in. While the U.S. economy has seen significant growth since the Great Recession, it will eventually dip again. With the next recession, economists say it's less a question of if it's going to happen, but when. Our next guest recently wrote about how the next recession could be devastating for millennials. Annie Lowry covers economic policy for The Atlantic. Annie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the millennials in particular, what kind of things are we hearing from the economists out there about the potential for another recession in the next few years?
So, you know, we certainly don't seem to be in a recession currently. You know, there are some mounting headwinds is the way that I would put it. So we've seen that there is a decline in manufacturing. There's been a slowdown in manufacturing. And so that is going to hit some states such as Wisconsin that have a strong manufacturing base. There's kind of ongoing problems from President Trump's trade war, which are hitting a lot of businesses that import goods. Or parts for goods, and as well as consumers who are seeing some rising prices. There's something called an inversion happening in the bond market, which is where basically our investors are guessing that things are going to be turbulent in the near term. That tends to be a pretty strong recession signal. And, you know, like job growth is not great. So despite the fact that the unemployment rate is really low, it doesn't seem like there's kind of a lot of juice in the economy. All of these things, again, you know, it's not like it doesn't feel like it's 2007, 2008 again, but it just means that, you know, there's a little bit of air coming out of the balloon and people are starting to get worried.
And the disturbing thing about that, I mean, recessions are never a happy time, but it's especially worrisome for millennials, you write, because in a lot of ways, you say they haven't really recovered from the last recession, the Great Recession. Talk about where millennials are now, even 10 years out.
Yeah, so the last recession was gigantic and was miserable for absolutely everyone, right? Nobody got through that recession feeling good at all. But since then, there's been a pretty significant boom in asset prices. So if you own stock or you own something like a house or a commercial property, you've actually done pretty well, right? You've recovered. The issue with the millennials is that they have not taken part in that recovery, that kind of net worth recovery. They had all of this student loan debt. They've had jobs that have not paid as well or seen the kind of wage growth that the jobs that the Gen Xers or the boomers had at the same point in their life cycle were getting. And, you know, they, because of that student loan debt and because of the cost of housing increasing so fast, as well as tight credit, you know, they haven't been able to buy houses. Their rate of home ownership is about 8 percentage points lower than, again, that of Gen X or the boomers at the same point in their lives. And so, you know, they're still renting. They're still desperate to amass savings. They are delaying things like getting married or having a family because they still feel financially precarious. And there's concerns that they are going to be sort of the first generation in modern economic history to end up worse than their parents.
Let's key in on one of those items, the student loan debt, for especially a particular cohort, a few years worth of millennials, if you will. You write about this in your piece in The Atlantic. They came into college, the costs were high, they've gone up a lot, they came out of college, the jobs weren't there. So they'd build up this huge student loan debt and the jobs they might have been hoping for all of a sudden weren't there. That age cohort must be really particularly hard hit, right?
Absolutely. And so canonically in the media, oftentimes the cases that we talk about are the pretty rare students that rack up like $100,000 in debt for liberal arts college. And you know, that's a significant problem. But the much bigger problem is with folks who racked up $5,000 or $10,000 of debt and didn't finish their degree and then got off on kind of jobs that were like not especially remunerative, didn't have a great career track, and also have this debt to service, which makes it really hard to save for a down payment for a home or to get a loan for a home. Those are the folks that you know, we have a whole generation of people. We're basically running a giant social experiment on what it means to take a really large debt and put it on, you know, 20 and 30 year olds and then say, okay, go ahead, go out in the economy and try and do what your parents or your older cousins did. And it's just not going great. And so, you know, we now have about $1.5 trillion of student loan debt throughout the economy. A lot of that accrued to the millennials, and they are just servicing and struggling with those debts.
Talking to Annie Lowry, she covers economic policy at The Atlantic, talking about a recent piece she wrote on how the Great Recession affected millennials and how a new recession could swamp them all over again. And Annie, let's talk about that piece of the puzzle now. If and when this next recession comes, what does that mean for these millennials we're talking about who may still have that student loan debt, didn't have that stock investment, didn't have that house to build up wealth over the last 10 years?
Right. So again, if there's a recession, it's just going to be bad for everybody. If there's a steep decline in asset prices, that's going to hit those boomers and those older Gen Xers who tend to hold the most assets, as well as those members of the greatest generation. So it's going to be bad for everybody. But the millennials never had any debt to never had those assets to start off with. And so they might actually not have as dramatic decreases in their net worth, but that would only be because they didn't have that much net worth to begin with, if that makes sense. And importantly, those assets act as a kind of financial buoy. So if you lose your job, if things are really bleak out there, you can dip into your retirement savings to make sure that the bills are paid and make sure that you're not going to get evicted. And the issue with the millennials is they really just don't have that safety net. Now a lot of them are at the age where they both have children and are taking care of their parents, which is a pretty heavy burden. And so, you know, if you don't have any savings and you can't make your rent, right, eventually you're going to get evicted. It makes it really hard to, for instance, move for a job. They're just in that kind of financially precarious state. Whereas, you know, again, for everybody else, recessions aren't good for everybody, but maybe they're going to have a little bit more of a cushion.
Out of the Great Recession, now going back 90-ish years or so, we hear about the people who came out of that being very risk-averse, very conservative with their money. Have we seen a similar thing with the millennials who kind of went through that Great Recession at a key point in their lives?
Yeah, I think so. When you talk to sociologists as opposed to economists about the millennials, you know, there's these kind of stereotypes that the millennials are sort of self-obsessed, they're job hopping, they're into wellness culture, they only care about avocado toast. And that seems like it's really wrong, right? The millennials are actually kind of small C conservative. They really want the things that their parents had, and they just might not be able to get them, right? They are going to school in really, really high numbers. They want to be married. They want to have kids. They often feel like financially that can't happen for them. And so, you know, again, they're actually against the media stereotype, they're all kind of like, they're kind of squires, right? But these things are just really, really tough for them. And I think down the road, the question is, you know, if they can't buy those houses, if they are having kids late, you know, how does that look 10 or 20 years from now? Because that could be bad economically for the whole economy, not just for them.
We're talking to Annie Lowry. She covers economic policy for The Atlantic. We're talking about the impact the next recession could have on millennials and maybe Generation Z as well, and the lingering after effects of the Great Recession on that generation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried that we'll have another recession soon? Do you feel prepared for one? And if you are a millennial, one of the age cohorts we're talking about in particular, how did the Great Recession impact you and your own personal economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about how people, especially millennials and maybe Generation Z, will be impacted by the next recession and how the Great Recession affected millennials. Our guest is Annie Lowry. She covers economic policy for The Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about a coming recession? If you are part of the millennial generation, how did the Great Recession impact you? Did you hit the job market right at the time when there wasn't much of a job market? Do you feel like you've recovered much since then? Has it affected your ability to pay off a student loan debt, to buy a house, start a family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Annie, I want to dig into another part of this story that you mentioned earlier, housing for millennials. They weren't able to afford a house when housing prices were lower during the Great Recession. As they maybe got some kind of financial stability, we saw so many places in the country have these booming housing costs. What do things look like now?
So it's a really, really interesting trend. So in a lot of more urban areas, there's not been a lot of building that has happened to accommodate kind of natural population growth, as well as the tendency of folks to move from rural areas to cities, which is kind of still happening in the United States. And so what has happened is that millennials have remained renters for way longer than their parents did. And what it means, and this is a very rough approximation, but what it means is that you have folks who tend to be older and whiter, who tend to be the homeowners or the investors that are purchasing these rental properties, that are then renting them out to a generation that is younger and more diverse and much, in some cases, lower income and definitely lower wealth. And this is kind of a generational transfer of wealth, because as this goes on, it means that the millennials are pretty much paying the boomers to live in the houses. There are some places where this problem is really acute, you know, really big, expensive urban areas, you know, like Chicago or on the coast. Places also, you know, in Texas, it happens all over the country in urban areas, but it's, you know, it's a really broad trend, and it has to do, as we talked about before, with the homeownership rate of millennials being significantly lower than it was for other cohorts at the same point in their life cycle.
Yeah, we heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Chris, who says, what about us Xers? We're approaching 50. We came of age during multiple recessions, and we entered our 40s in the Great Recession. Chris writes, we're worried just as much as anyone else. A lot of us took a huge hit during that time. Some had to go back to school to get degrees and took on some debt as well. And in your piece, you say, yes, that happened, Annie, but when you compare whatever benchmark you want, same age from generation to generation, millennials do seem to come out worse, don't they?
Yeah, so the issue with the millennials is that it seems like there is an effect that happens when you come of age during a recession. So when your cohort is kind of coming into their early 20s during a recession, it has deeper and longer lasting effects on your lifetime earnings. And so millennials just had the crummy fortune to come of age in the worst recession since the 1920s. Right? It was really bad for them. That said, if you were like 22 years old and had just gotten your associate's degree or were graduating from college during one of the recessions in the 80s or the 90s, it wasn't great for you either, right? And certainly I would say that the Gen Xers have had some kind of mix of things happen to them, right? The baby boomers have really benefited from a lot of trends in wealth. And the millennials far less so, and the Gen Xers have ended up someplace in between. But again, you know, I think that the broader point is good, which is that, like, things have just not been great. The tide has not been sort of lifting all boats in the United States economy for a really long time, and Gen Xers have absolutely felt a lot of those effects. And so, you know, I think that that's also, you know, something to gesture to, right? Like, if we've had really stagnant median wages and a lot of rising economic pressures for all families, that's something that's hitting members of all generations.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Beach Park, Illinois. James, hi.
Hi. Yeah, the Great Recession, it was rather interesting for me. I worked for a major company, and after, you know, I retired with full benefits, and what I thought I had and what I ended up with was quite a different story. And what I thought I was going to do in retirement, and what I actually did were two different things. But actually, it was a great learning experience. And fortunately, I was very economical before the Great Recession, so I had a reserve. And I have a small rental-type property, and I actually hired people. And, you know, everything, they were so willing to work and, you know, for a lot less wages, and I was able to do more. But it was a tough time because, and that's just something that I did was to save money before it happened, and I had a reserve.
James, thanks a lot for that call. James did have some tough times there, but he had that reserve built up. And again, going back to your piece, Andy, it was hard for millennials. I mean, they didn't have jobs yet in many cases, or serious jobs yet before the recession hit, to have that reserve.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've not managed to build one up. And I think it's kind of interesting to think about this in terms of wealth or income inequality between cohorts as well as within cohorts. So between cohorts, right, roughly speaking, across the whole economy, the baby boomers are the ones who are sort of sitting on the financial assets. They are the ones who own stock. They are the ones who own the houses, the rental properties, the commercial properties. And you know, the millennials are the ones who are on the other end of that, who are still renting, who don't really own stock, who don't own a ton of property. But within cohorts, there's also a lot of inequality, right? So some millennials could fall back on their parents and made it through the recession just fine. And then other millennials, you know, really didn't. They had no family wealth to fall back on. They took on a lot of debt to go to school, maybe didn't finish school, didn't get that earnings boost from it. Similarly, there's plenty of boomers that got hit just very hard during the recession. And unlike James, hadn't been able to plan for it or hadn't planned for it, didn't have those financial assets to help them, and are really facing a terrifying retirement up ahead of them. As he pointed out, you know, he retired with what he thought was, you know, benefits, maybe some kind of pension. That kind of financial security has gone away, which is why we see more and more people who really don't have much other than Social Security to help them out in retirement.
Thanks for that call, David. We're talking to Annie Lowry from The Atlantic about the impact of the Great Recession on millennials, the risk that a new recession could come along. Ashley joins us now in Milwaukee. Ashley, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a mid-30 millennial. My husband and I graduated college in late 2000s. I in the social service sector, he in business. For the first 6 years of our marriage, I in the social service sector was the sole income earner, and we had enough money to buy a house, but at the same time we had children, so we had a lot of nanny and child care costs that was required of us at the time. And now as we're in our mid-30s, we're finding that we're having to try and get above all of the debt that we accrued in our 20s, and it's incredibly difficult. On paper, it looks like we should be doing really well. We're homeowners. We have health insurance, both really stable full-time jobs. But because of the cost of living in our 20s, we're here just trying to make it work. And I really appreciate this conversation because there are those of us that are homeowners that are just trying to make it day by day because of the way we had to come into age, as you were saying, back when we graduated college. And it's hard.
Ashley, thanks a lot for that call. Probably not a crazy uncommon story, Annie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Ashley and her husband's story points to another major factor of this, which is that, yes, the cost of education has increased a lot, and we've seen young people take on a lot of debt to go to school, which really wasn't a thing 30 or 40 years ago. Another thing that the cost has increased a ton of is healthcare costs, right, especially those premium co-pays, deductibles, and child care costs. Where if you don't have a flexible job or a family member to help out, it is extraordinarily expensive to have a two-year-old, and you're facing years and years and years of perhaps additional child care costs beyond that. I think that that's another reason that folks have delayed having kids, just to try to put themselves on a sounder footing, because if you have a student loan bill, and a mortgage or a rent payment, and also, you know, you're paying for preschool or nanny share or daycare, it's really, really tough, even in two earner households. It's just really tough to make the math work. And I think that that's true for people who, again, as she pointed out, who are doing everything right, right? Who are trying really hard to make the right decisions and are not profligate, going crazy spending. It's just really tough to make those numbers work.
Ashley, thanks a lot for that call. We heard from David on the Ideas Network Facebook page. He says, I'm technically a post-millennial, born in 94. It's going to be rough for us as well. Entering a tepid and tumultuous job market is going to be similarly difficult. And I seem to recall, Annie, you end your piece with kind of an ominous warning that maybe Generation Z could face a tougher time.
Yeah, look, like Generation Z, so broadly speaking, the kids of the Gen Xers in a lot of cases, or even some of the old millennials, if they come of age in a recession, that's not going to be great for them. And they are some of these first kids who are born to these families where their parents are carrying a lot of student debt, where their parents are renting instead of owning because they just can't afford it, where their parents have two folks in the household who are earners, still have those exorbitant child care costs, or, you know, they're in single parent families where the math also gets really brutally tough in terms of just making sure that you're keeping your head above water. So, you know, if we don't start to see a really vibrant, thriving, growing middle class driven by wage growth in the middle and on the lower end, you know, it's going to continue being pretty hard. That said, you know, the Great Recession was really sui generis, hopefully a kind of once-in-a-lifetime occurrence for most of us here. And economists do think that if there is another recession, that it's quite unlikely that it would be as financially impactful and terrible as the Great Recession was. So, you know, we can all cross our fingers on that one.
Annie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Annie Lowry covers economic policy for The Atlantic. She joined us today to talk about how millennials could be affected if and when the next recession hits and the still ongoing economic impact of the Great Recession on the millennial generation and others. Still time for you to share your thoughts and maybe your own story over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's been 249 days since the Green Bay Packers' last regular season game, a 31-0 loss at home against the Detroit Lions. That capped off a disappointing 6-9-1 season in which the team missed the playoffs for the second straight year. It also spelled the end to Mike McCarthy's 13-year run as head coach. He was fired after a Week 13 loss to the lowly Arizona Cardinals at Lambeau Field. Since then, they've brought in a new coach with a new offensive game plan. They also signed some high-profile defensive free agents and used their two first-round draft picks to shore up the defense. We'll get our first real look at the new squad tonight when the Packers kick off the regular season at the Bears. Tom Silverstein is the Packers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Tom, good to have you with us.
Hey, thank you.
Well, I know preseason isn't always a guide, but you do have some predictions out there about the Packers season. What are your impressions of the new look for the Packers so far?
Well, this is probably the hardest year I've had in a while for making predictions because we know so little about what kind of team the Packers are going to be offensively. They have a new coach with a new offense, and they've not shown a lot of it in the preseason games. So this is our first real look at what they'll be like in live action. I've seen a lot of practices, and so you get kind of an idea of what they'll look like, but until you see it against a defense that's trying to stop what they do, you don't know how successful they're going to be. So, the history of in the NFL and in Green Bay of first-year coaches having really good years in their inaugural year is not good. Most coaches hover right around 8-8. And that's sort of where I have the Packers, right in there, 7-9, something like that.
One of the knocks from some people on previous coach Mike McCarthy was that his offense wasn't creative enough to use the talents of Aaron Rodgers. The hopes for the new coach, Matt LaFleur, are that he will be. What do we know? What can we read about that so far?
Well, my feeling was that McCarthy's offense was very much a matchup offense, and you needed to have more talent than the other team, and their talent on offense was starting to dwindle. And so with LaFleur, it's more of what you would consider a scheming offense, which means they scheme to get people open. They don't just count on them having better players than the other team. So that's what we'll be looking for. You'll see lots of pick routes where one receiver is sort of shielding the defender for another. You'll see lots of fake handoffs and throwing downfield off of that. Lots of gimmicks, too. You'll see end-arounds and jet sweeps and all those kind of things that you probably didn't see in the previous offense.
One of the big questions on and off for the Packers over the years has been the running game. If they fake a handoff, does anybody care if they can't run anyway? What are you seeing there so far?
Well, this offense is predicated on play action, faking to the running back and then trying to get the linebackers to come in and play the run and then running a receiver right where those linebackers were and, you know, hitting that in an open space. You have to run the ball, and otherwise those linebackers are not going to be super aggressive and they're going to kind of take a wait-and-see approach. If you're running the ball really well, they're going to get aggressive and chase the run. So you really do have to run the ball, and the Packers have a system that only a few teams are running. It's called a wide zone offense, and really it's just trying to spread the defense out and then trying to find a cutback lane for the running back. So we'll see. The Bears' defense is outstanding, and they're really good against the run. So it's going to be a challenge.
One of the big questions over the years has been, how much does Aaron Rodgers change the play at the line? Forget what the coach called. He calls his own play. We don't know what's going to happen this year, but one thing that does seem clear, new coach Matt LaFleur is sick of being asked about it, right?
Yeah, he is. You know, it's going to be – it's an issue because as Mike McCarthy's offense grew, Aaron Rodgers received more responsibility to the point where he had a pretty large menu. When the play came in, there were a number of options for him to go to. If he didn't like the way the defense was set up, if it looked like the play was going to run right into the defense's strength, he had some plays that he could go to. It's not that he was calling his own plays, but he had a fair amount of alternatives. In LaFleur's system, typically there's one play called from the sideline and one option. And, you know, with Rodgers' experience and smarts, you probably want to expand that menu. The question is, how big are they expanding that menu? And that's what we don't know, and that's what they're not telling us.
Talking to Tom Silverstein, Packers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, watching ahead at the Packers season with opening day tonight. Tom, we've been talking about the offense so far. What are you watching for on the defensive side for the Packers?
Well, I want to see whether their pass rush is that much more improved. They've added some high-priced players in free agency, specifically Preston Smith and Za'Darius Smith. They're both outside linebackers with pass rush ability. And they replace Clay Matthews and Nick Perry, two longtime outside linebackers. And they're younger, and we'll find out whether they can handle or can produce the kind of pass rush that the Packers need. I also want to look at their secondary. They're very deep there, and they've worked hard to improve that area, and this will be a good test for them. We'll see whether they can get their hands on more passes, whether they can get more interceptions, and this will be a good test for them.
Now the Packers start their season in Chicago against long-term rivals, the Bears. If I can use some Wall Street language, Tom, you are bearish on the Packers. You are bullish on the Bears.
I really like the Bears. I think their defense is fantastic, and I think their season pretty much depends on their quarterback, Mitch Trubisky. He's a young guy. He's starting to develop. He saw signs of it at the end of last year. He, from all reports, did not have a good training camp, but that doesn't matter. It all matters today. And they're going to be in every game because of their defense. The question is, can they get any farther than the first round of the playoffs with their quarterback? And we'll find out today. I mean, today's a good test for him as well. He's going up against a fairly good defense that knows him. And so, you know, he's under the microscope as well.
With this opening game between the Bears and the Packers, Chicago seems to be the team to beat in the division. So that makes this a really, I mean, they're all significant games. This is a really significant game for the Packers, right?
Well, it's important that they get off to a good start. It's not critical that they win. Typically, you know, if you can split home and home with your division rivals, you know, you'll be okay. I mean, you do want to beat your rivals twice, but you have to be realistic, too. This is the first game under the new head coach, and your assumption is that they'll be better in December when they play the Bears again at Lambeau Field than they are right now. So I never think that the first game is really critical. It doesn't really matter who it's against, because you start to judge teams probably from the midway point of the season on. And that's when you know the teams that are really getting hot at that point, those are the ones that are going to go to the playoffs. So I think this is more just like a litmus test to find out where this team is at.
So if it's a bad game from the Packers' perspective, Tom, it sounds like you're saying don't throw away the cheese heads just yet.
No, I mean, McCarthy in his very first game lost 29-0 to the Bears. And they finished the season 8-8. And they finished, I think it was winning like four of their last five games. So you can't judge anything on a first game, whether it's for the Bears or the Packers. But it's just a starting point. And it's about time, because it was a really long preseason. And I think everybody's ready for the real games.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Tom Silverstein is the Packers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about the 2019 Packers season, which kicks off tonight in Chicago against the Bears. By the way, Las Vegas is giving the Packers the 10th best odds of winning the Super Bowl at about 18-1, same as the Vikings, Cowboys, and Seahawks. The Bears are tied for third best at 12-1. Republican U.S. Congressional Representative Jim Sensenbrenner announced yesterday that he won't be seeking re-election. He says he'll retire after his term ends next fall. Sensenbrenner was first elected in 1978 and served 21 terms in Congress. He says the time has come to pass the torch and the choice comes on his own terms. He's speaking here with radio host Mark Belling on WISN AM.
I always knew that when the time came for me to step aside, I would come to that conclusion, and I've done that now. It's been a great run for the last 42 years. I think I've made a difference both for our district and our country.
That decision could set up an interesting Republican primary in the conservative 5th Congressional District. Several state and local politicians have already said they're considering running for the seat. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for being here.
Hey, Rob.
Well, one point of trivia, I guess by the time he retires, actually, I guess it would be in January after the election next year, he would be the longest serving member of Congress ever. He would, by that point, beat out Wisconsin's own Dave Obie.
You're telling me this for the first time. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. So we have long-running Congress people here in the state, I guess, is the lesson here.
And I remember some of the same things being said when Dave Obie stepped down, too, that this doesn't happen very often. And you had a bunch of people at that time considering a bid because, you know, when you have this long-time congressman that's been in there, it's like a huge door opening and one that may not open again for people who are into politics.
Yeah, if you were a Republican politician in this district or a Democrat in Dave Obie's, or I think there's a Fred Risser phenomenon in the state Senate, and you look at that next step in the ladder and you know that step just is going to keep being occupied for as long as that person wants it, you're hankering for that next opportunity.
No doubt. And then you kind of combine that with just the makeup of the 5th Congressional District. And especially for Republicans, this is the heart of the GOP base. I mean, you're talking about Dodge County, Jefferson County, Milwaukee County, Walworth County, Washington County and Waukesha County. So we're always looking at Washington and Waukesha counties in particular when we're looking at election results for how a statewide contest is going to go, because they're just such huge GOP vote centers. And so you have this very concentrated Republican district, this kind of pent up political ambition in that district. And here it's all coming into play.
Now, Sensenbrenner, I don't think he ever had like serious competition from a Democrat. But since 2011, with the maps that were drawn then, this safe seat went from, you know, safe Republican to, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's never really been in doubt. I mean, it is interesting if you look at his numbers in the most recent election, the 2018 election. I mean, it was a landslide victory, but not as big of a landslide as you've seen in previous elections. You know, we don't know the reasons for that exactly. I mean, Democrats did win on the statewide level, so that's a factor. But it did come at a time when Republicans were struggling with voters that they'd traditionally done well with. You know, suburban Republican voters were a bit cool to Donald Trump in 2016, and there are signs that that may be carrying over into 2018 and beyond.
So on the Democratic side of things, there's probably not a lot of Democratic strategists putting this up on their board of possible turnovers. It would take something really big and probably weird for that seat to flip.
It would. I mean, they'll run somebody. Oh, we already have an announced candidate. In fact, the only very firm announced candidate that I've heard so far has been from the Democrat that ran against Sensenbrenner in 2018, and that was Tom Palswicks. This is not a seat that is going to be on a list of Democratic flips or pickups. You know, when they talk about where to send national money, which seats they want to target, they're going to, you know, practically speaking, leave this one to Republicans to fight over.
And I want to talk about the Republicans who are considering in just a bit, but I want to take a couple minutes to talk about Sensenbrenner's career in Congress. We don't have to do the full bio right now. He's still there for another year and a third or so. But what were some of the key highlights of his career to date in Congress?
It's hard for us to kind of sum up his career in Congress because it goes back 40 years.
Yeah, we were talking, the Iran hostage crisis was erupting as, you know, soon after he came into office,
right,
for example.
Yeah, I mean, life in the 70s was a little bit different when he began office. And he'd been in the state legislature, by the way, for, you know, about 10 years before mm-hmm. that. So a long career in government for Jim Sensenbrenner. You know, just looking back through some of the coverage of Jim Sensenbrenner over the years, stories highlight some of his big bills, like he was the lead author on the Patriot Act. He was took a lead role in the impeachment proceedings with President Bill Clinton. And, you know, in a lot of the coverage of Jim Sensenbrenner, it focuses on his personality, you know, kind of his tendencies. I was looking at one July 2006 article in the New York Times. Headline is "Pit Bull of the House Latches On to Immigration." And I mean, they use a variety of words to describe Sensenbrenner in that article. Not the reporter, but his friends called him prickly, cantankerous, unpleasant, idiosyncratic, and pit bull. And these are Republicans who are saying, yeah, he's pretty tough. You know, that's the reputation of Sensenbrenner, is that he's not going to back down on anything and not necessarily going to bend to leadership if he really gets his mind set on an issue. And I think you could see that at the state level, too, in Wisconsin. I mean, Sensenbrenner could sometimes, I mean, I don't want to say always, but he would sort of set the lead for where Wisconsin Republicans are going to go on an issue or a difficult situation. I'm thinking about like President Donald Trump in 2016. A lot of Wisconsin Republicans were not loving Trump at the time. And Sensenbrenner came out and said, look, he won fair and square. And if you don't vote for him, you're going to be casting a vote for Hillary Clinton, essentially. And that became the mantra for Wisconsin Republicans over the next few months.
Talking to WPR's own Sean Johnson about Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, he announced he would not run for re-election next year. By the time he leaves at that point, it looks like he would be the longest serving congressman, period, in American history, I think, if they have the numbers right. Now, let's look at the efforts to replace him on the Republican side. A lot of people thinking about it. Whoever wins the Republican primary has got to be considered a substantial favorite to win then in November. What kind of names and positions are you hearing, Sean?
I think at this point, probably the danger that we have here, Rob, is that we'll leave a name out for somebody
right.
who is thinking about
somebody's announcing the thing about it as we're talking, probably.
Probably. And, you know, these are coming out as, you know, lots of people have asked me to run, or I'm being encouraged to run, or I'm exploring it, that type of stuff, you know, statements that you hear from maybe candidates. So we can start with a couple people who were on statewide ballots last year. Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson are both apparently eyeing a run for this district. They ran for the U.S. Senate. I mean, they both had a bid for the U.S. Senate, and Vukmir won the primary against Nicholson and went on to lose against Democrat Tammy Baldwin in the statewide general election. Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader of the state Senate, is looking at this. You know, Fitzgerald served with Vukmir in the Senate, both in a leadership capacity. They know each other pretty well. So, you know, if he were to run, that would kind of set off a domino effect. Paul Farrow, the Waukesha County executive, another name being thrown out there. Senators Chris Kapinga and Dale Coinga apparently looking at this. And then Ben Vocal, who is a spokesperson for Ron Johnson, is another name that's been out there. If you are a Republican in the Waukesha County area and this is something that you ever thought you were going to try, they're saying now's the time.
One correction, Sean. I got an idea in my head, and my producers are correcting me. Longest serving in Wisconsin history in Congress. John Dingell served more than 50 years. Of course, I should have known that. That's why it was news to you.
Yeah. There we go, right?
It was not true.
I had no way to verify this, okay. So I'm glad that we cleared that up.
Yes, thank you, producers, for that one. So a lot of people. Now, how in this very Republican district, those high-profile names, maybe lesser-recognized names, and we've got a long time to figure this out, how do they start to distinguish themselves among their fellow Republicans?
Some of them are going to be able to distinguish themselves right away. You know, if you've run for a statewide office before, you have a donor list, you have contacts, you know, you have recognition, statewide name recognition or district-wide name recognition. You know, people who've been in elected office for a long time in that area are going to be known by voters in that area. So that's not going to hurt. You know, beyond that, I don't know how big this primary field is actually going to be. You could imagine it being huge. You could also imagine that as these names actually get in to the race, some of the people who were kind of on, you know, the fringe would look at the list of candidates and say, you know, maybe this isn't my time. You know, this isn't going to work out for me, and I'm throwing my support behind, you know, you name it, whoever.
And this will be the second piece of turnover among Republicans. Sean Duffy already said he's stepping out. He's not going to wait it out. There will be a special election to replace him. So all of a sudden, I'm not sure which, but Glenn Grothman and Mike Gallagher become the veterans, the deans of the Republican Congressional Caucus from Wisconsin.
Of the Republican. And then Ron Kind is going to be the dean of the Wisconsin Congressional Delegation.
Right.
He'll be elected in 1996. So
whippersnappers.
Yeah, right. Going to move up a couple decades in terms of the dean status.
All right. Well, it'll be a big change of a household name there, long serving, four decades there. Moving on, Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief. He talked to us about Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, who announced yesterday that he won't be seeking re-election. He served in Congress since 1978. I'll re-correct myself. He was the longest-serving Wisconsin member of Congress, not national, as I mistakenly said earlier. This sets up a big Republican primary in his mostly conservative district. If you live in the district, if Jim Sensenbrenner represents you, let us know what you're looking for in a candidate for that seat next year. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can do it the old-fashioned way and email us at ideas@WPR.org. If you're a Democrat in that district, do you have high hopes? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Have you ever looked in the history of the building you live in or the land it's built on? We've had conversations with experts on the history of buildings and neighborhoods who told us how to find out what things looked like 50 or 100 years ago. But how about going back a little bit further? Say, 100 million years ago. A new online globe called Ancient Earth lets you enter in a city or state or even an address and find out what the place might have looked like over the last 700 million years. The map uses estimates that account for continental drift and changing sea levels. You can find the map at the website dinosaurmaps.org. And you can enter in time periods from the present day back through the earliest days of multicellular life. One warning, it only shows oceans and land, not lakes. So even when you look at the present day, you don't see the Great Lakes there. It's a little disorienting. All right, I took it for a spin. The globe, get it? I entered in a couple cities around Wisconsin. Here's what to expect if you were to jump in a time machine. T-I-M-E, not T-Y-M-E. 300 million years ago, bring a bathing suit. The southern strip of the state is some prime oceanfront property. 500 million years ago, wear that bathing suit. We're underwater. 700 million years ago, we're on dry land again with a sweet view of a big mountain range to the south. Again, that ancient globe is at dinosaurmaps.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.